It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we explore the latest plans in the current overhaul of Milwaukee County's mental health services.
But first, Jennifer Morales was the first Latina member of the Milwaukee School Board and spent 2 decades living in that city. Her collection of intertwined short stories called Meet Me Halfway, Milwaukee Stories, highlights the divisions between people, but also the things that they have in common. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your stories are told from different characters' perspectives, and they span different periods of time, but they all have one tragic event as a common element. Tell us about Jonquel Braxton.
Jonquel is a high-achieving African-American high school senior who is attending Whitefish Bay High School through the Voluntary Integration Program, and he's a Milwaukee resident. He helps out an elderly white neighbor in his Sherman Park neighborhood and has an accident while helping her and is sent to the hospital. And through that experience, the family members, the neighbors, begin to start challenging themselves to cross boundaries of race and social class and sexual orientation and age and really start making connections.
And your book of short stories is about that. It's about all of those boundaries and how people can cross them, sexual orientation, race, age, gender, all of those things. Why did you want to tie those into what you saw in the city of Milwaukee?
Well, I'm originally from the Chicago area, and I come from a multiracial family and a multiracial group of friends. And when I came to Milwaukee in 1991, I was just really shocked at how divided the city felt. And I knew frequently if somebody told me their address, I could tell you what race they were. There was definitely a political divide between the older generations and the newer generations. And so I felt all these divisions as a resident of Milwaukee, as a person who was trying to represent the needs of kids in Milwaukee through the school board work. And it really compelled me all these years to try to tease out why is Milwaukee this way? Why don't people cross those lines? And so this is my imaginative attempt to bridge those gaps.
And the woman who lives next door to Jonquel, her name is Mrs. Zernicki, and she has some ideas about the Braxton family. They're African-American, but she does find she becomes almost a family member and that she becomes more involved with their lives. And as she does so, that the realities are a lot more complex than she first thinks that they are. In a city as segregated as Milwaukee is, are those intercultural connections today, do you think, harder to come by?
I don't think they're harder to come by, especially starting in the past year. I think that there's a lot more dialogue happening. There's always been people in the city of Milwaukee who have worked to cross boundaries, but I think with the unfortunate events and the prominence of them between African-American teens, for the most part, and the police, this racial dialogue that's starting in the United States opens up the door for Milwaukee to start addressing some of those issues more deeply and really on an interpersonal and institutional level.
So you say you've seen that happening in the last year. Can you give me an example of the conversations you've seen starting that maybe wouldn't have happened a couple years ago?
Well, I think about Greater Together, which was an initiative from essentially a graphic design marketing firm leader who said, my employees live in very specific parts of the city. What would our city look like if they felt comfortable living in any part of the city, if every part of the city was as good as the ones that my employees choose to live in? And he sparked this conversation where there was a competition to provide some ideas for ways to bridge the gaps. I don't remember how many they got, but they got over 100 applications of people who had great ideas about how to integrate different groups, how to overcome some of those barriers. And so they're actually putting money and corporate power behind this conversation, which I think is an interesting turn of events. But there's plenty of other groups who have been working on it as well, such as the Interfaith Conference and the ACLU and other organizations.
We're talking right now with Jennifer Morales, the first Latina member of the Milwaukee School Board, talking about her new book of short stories called Meet Me Halfway. Milwaukee stories. And Jennifer, you write in your introduction that a lot of publishers shied away from stories that were about race. Why do you think people are afraid to talk about it, and is that changing?
Well, because the United States was, a lot of United States wealth, I should say, was founded on the slavery system. I think that there is a certain gut sense among many people that to start talking about racial imbalance, racial inequality, racism will produce a conversation that means institutions have to change, that systems of privilege have to change. And those are scary things for people because they don't know what that would look like. So when I talk to, for example, white people who are hesitant to talk about racism, I like to encourage them to think, what kind of relief would you feel if you didn't have to be part of upholding those systems anymore? So, you know, my book, I feel, is a kind of invitation for whoever you are, black, white, gay, straight, old, Latino, young, whoever you might be, suburban, rural, urban, to start talking about that through the avenue of fiction, because in some ways it helps lower some of those defenses.
And Jennifer, as we wrap up, you care a lot about youth. You've been a community activist and a volunteer working with young people. What do you want people to get, young people, about what they need to thrive, and what? How do they inform your book?
Well, obviously, education is really important. I really feel we need to invest in schools. We need to invest in children's opportunities of all sorts. But I also think a very basic step is for people in Milwaukee to challenge themselves, especially older white people, and I'm going to put that out there, to challenge themselves to see children of color, youth of color, as people who have fears and interests and desires and ambitions and talents. And this is very basic, but it's so essential that we really start seeing each other, and especially the kids, as people.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Morales was with us there. She lived for more than 20 years in Milwaukee, where she raised children and served on the Milwaukee Board of School Directors, the first Latino elected there. She now lives in Viroqua, Wisconsin, where she's a member of the Council for Wisconsin Writers and the Driftless Writing Center.
Milwaukee County has been working for years to overhaul a mental health system that many observers say has been falling short. A year ago, the county board was stripped of its oversight of that system. It's since been in the hands of a mental health board appointed by the governor.
Many of the mental health system services have been contracted out to private providers during the last decade, and the latest proposal would be the final step in that process, the closure of the Milwaukee Mental Health Complex. It's a large complex that was built during a time when many of the country's mentally ill were institutionalized.
The Mental Health Board has put out a request for proposals to take over its acute and emergency services, some of the most serious and immediate psychiatric problems in the county, and this is similar to what many other, maybe even most other counties do around the country. Meg Kissinger joins us now with more on the topic. She's an investigative reporter who's been covering the challenges facing mental health care in Milwaukee since the mid-1980s. Meg, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So why are county officials looking to ultimately close Milwaukee's mental health complex?
Well, for a lot of reasons. You know, primarily because it's just kind of outmoded. Not too many places run, not too many counties run their own psychiatric hospitals anymore. And it's just become expensive and difficult. And following best practices, they're looking to, you know, follow the lead of Dane County and outsource the emergency and acute care.
Right, a lot of the things that were done at this complex have already left the complex, as I understand it. Is that right?
That's right. By the end of this calendar year, they will have emptied the ward, the long-term care ward. You know, at one time, that facility had over 800 patients, the whole spectrum from somebody walking through the emergency room door to long-term care. Some people live there 20 and 30 and 40 years. And so those long-term patients are finally being ushered out and put into group homes.
And you mentioned acute and emergency care, and that seems like it's the sticking point for this to be done. But first of all, who is walking through the door? Who's being brought to the door in this acute and emergency care situation?
Well, the patients, you know, who you'd see really in any city. So people in a psychiatric crisis, and those are very often people brought in by police officers. So, you know, somebody is having a psychotic break, and their family members or whomever will pick up the phone and call the police, and lacking another place to take them, will take them to the emergency room at the county psychiatric hospital. Or there's walk-ins. You know, somebody is feeling like they're spinning out of control, and they can volunteer to go there. And so those are the patients that they see. And as we've talked about in the past, and as our stories have chronicled, you know, Milwaukee has the highest rate in the country of, or had, of patients, you know, returning, you know, coming back time and again.
So I assume nobody wants to replace that system with nothing, nowhere for these patients to go. So what is in the works? What is the county hoping to replace that acute and emergency care with?
So they are now putting out a request for proposals. So they're testing the environment to see, is there a nonprofit agency, a for-profit, who is interested in delivering that care? So there are companies, you know, both for-profit and not, that provide psychiatric services, and that's what they're aiming to see. Is somebody willing to step in and take over that function?
So what's the timeline on getting that figured out and getting those proposals and approving them?
That is to be determined, and we've yet to see the request for proposal. That is a process that isn't public until the proposal is put out. So once that is out for the public consumption, then we'll see what the timeline is. But you know, the county has been moving in this direction for quite some time.
In theory, this is something that works because lots of other counties do it. What would the county do to make sure, if they get these proposals, get them approved, to make sure that there's quality care being provided, that the needs of these patients are being met?
Well, that's the sticky wicket, and that's where that is where all the attention will be focused, or a lot of the attention will be focused. You know, it raises this question, you know, is there a moral imperative for Milwaukee County to provide mental health services for its citizens? And, you know, previously that was, or until now, or up and, you know, including now, that is being played out by the county's own hospital. So now they're shifting gears and transitioning to see, you know, again, if a private entity or some other entity will do that. And so it's incumbent, the county officials, the behavioral health division folks, say repeatedly they will put in quality assurance measures in place. So there's a way to test, engage, and make sure that, you know, patients are being provided good care.
Talking to Meg Kissinger from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about changes to the way Milwaukee provides mental health care, especially for people in acute and emergency situations. So this complex closing, Meg, one side question that's come up is, what happens to that complex? I saw one letter to the editor in your paper from a former resident there. He said, hey, can we convert this thing to apartments, some kind of subsidized housing for people with mental health challenges? What kind of ideas are out there for what happens after this goes away?
Well, that's an excellent idea, and that's an excellent question. You know, all that is up for grabs, and it's pretty valuable property. You know, it's the hospital itself, which opened in 1979, was, you know, believed at the time to be state-of-the-art, but that was at a time when there were seven or eight times as many patients being treated. So it's just a fraction of it is currently being used. So I suppose there'll be a lot of interest in how that building and how those grounds will be used.
Looking back to the patients now, the Affordable Care Act has changed a lot in the way health care is provided and paid for in the United States. Does this play a factor in mental health issues in the Milwaukee County area?
Sure, it does. And, you know, I'm told time and again that this has been a good thing for people in need of psychiatric care, that the Affordable Health Care Act covers, and especially with mental health parity, that more services are covered through public care. But the problem is finding providers who take Medicaid, Medicare. And so there is great demand, and there is the ability, if you can get the providers who will take that form of payment. So presumably there'll be more available to them.
And getting back to acute and emergency care, you mentioned earlier that sometimes patients are showing up in police custody or police bringing them to this complex. And, of course, we've heard about the shooting of Dontre Hamilton, a black man with mental health issues in Milwaukee. What has changed since then? Is that part of the conversation about how acute and emergency psychiatric problems are dealt with?
The Dontre Hamilton case underscores in the most tragic way, you know, what can happen when everything lines up wrong. So here was this guy asleep in a park, and what has happened as a result of that case is the Hamilton family has insisted in its negotiations with the city that better training for police officers be made available. So Milwaukee has now promised and is in the process of training all of its police officers in 40 hours of crisis intervention training, so mental health training. So that's a great byproduct of that very tragic situation. You know, has that solved the other issues? Not at all. So, you know, there are still plenty of people who are walking around without proper care and being misunderstood by the public and by police officers.
When we've talked in the past, Meg, you've mentioned that there's an effort to move toward community-based programming, something that's more accessible, closer to home, doesn't involve a full-on commitment to someplace like the mental health complex. Are we seeing those things emerging?
Yeah, there is, you know, the community is more embracing of that. You know, where there's worry now, everything comes full circle. You know, where there's worry now is, will there be enough inpatient care made available? Because the reality is that people with severe persistent mental illness at one time or another are, you know, likely to be in need of inpatient care. And so we can't close all the psychiatric beds. So community-based treatment, which is really mandated by the federal government, there's a requirement to provide care in the least restrictive setting. And Milwaukee, for a long time, has ignored that. And they're now, you know, this is why you're seeing this movement, finally, to embracing more community care. But again, will there be enough places for people who are truly in crisis and in need of acute care?
Big picture, Meg, you've been covering these issues for a long time in Milwaukee. Do things seem to be headed in a good direction in that span of time?
I think, you know, we've certainly got people's interests, and I think I know that there are good-hearted people who are very resolved and committed to providing better care, who are talking to one another more. But we are a long way from solving these issues. There's still quite a lot of lack of collaboration and cooperation, and people kind of protecting their own agendas. And for my way of thinking, you know, not as much of a collaborative spirit as we need to have.
Before I let you go, Meg, is there a role model in the country where people are saying, if only we could be more like blank county or blank city that you'd point to?
Well, you know, I've mentioned Columbus, Ohio in the past. They have long been a leader in providing good housing. It was really in your own city, in Madison, Dane County, where that was the birthplace of assertive community treatment, and, you know, the place where they realized that you have to, you cannot round up all the patients and take them to a building. You know, you need to have the hospital or the care go out into the community and meet people where they live. So that plan that was developed by Madison psychiatrists back in the 60s is still considered the gold standard.
Meg, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
We've been speaking to Meg Kissinger, investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her series, Chronic Crisis, has covered Milwaukee County's mental health system.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, world leaders reached a nuclear deal with Iran after 20 months of negotiations. We'll talk to a political scientist about the details of that deal and why some Republicans are speaking out against it.
First, you've probably heard by now that a certain governor of Wisconsin is running for president. Scott Walker made it official yesterday with a social media announcement in the morning, followed by a rally and an in-person announcement in the evening.
He joins 14 other declared Republicans in a crowded primary field, though recent polls have seen Walker near the top. He is in Nevada today. He'll spend the coming weeks and months trying to win over those voters in early primary states.
Joining us now to talk about Governor Walker's run for president and what we can expect in the coming months is Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
Well, Governor Walker hit what appears to be his campaign slogan yesterday, emphasizing that he's not just a fighter, he's also a winner. What else struck you about that part of the announcement yesterday?
It was an interesting line. By the way, I thought his speech was extremely well delivered. Many people noticed that he spoke without notes and basically memorized the speech, although parts of it were things that he had given in the past, but collectively it was a new speech. But I was struck by the fact that he seemed very calm, very cool. Delivering a speech of that length without notes and without teleprompters, frankly, was pretty impressive. And I think it was a good speech for that kind of crowd. You know, obviously these were supporters of his, and I thought it was pretty well received.
Did he give you a sense of who he is as a person, do you think? Did he start that personal narrative that the candidates need to develop as they go along to be successful?
Yes. Yeah, I think you have to introduce yourself to people. The audience probably is primarily a national audience. You know, you get your the day you make your announcements, you get a certain amount of national publicity, and I think sometimes they take the whole thing, sometimes they take excerpts. But I think he was obviously trying to introduce himself to those people who hadn't known much about him.
Now, one point of interest, a lot of Ronald Reagan in that speech last night, references to 80s politics. What do you make of the Reagan-era conservatism as a focal point?
Well, you know, he's probably the most revered figure in our lifetime for most Republicans. I do kind of joke, however, that if he was running for the presidency now, he'd probably be a little too moderate. But all that aside, he did change the direction of the country, and I think most people acknowledge that, to a more conservative direction. And as a result of that, saying something about Reagan is always a positive thing for any Republican audience.
Now, one of the lines last night that caught my ear, at least, he said that the biggest threat of our time, not climate change, but Islamic terrorism. That's a paraphrase. And he didn't necessarily need to kind of conflate the two in an either-or sort of scenario. What does that signal to you?
Would you repeat that? I didn't quite understand your question.
He said he saw the biggest threat of our time as not being climate change or global warming. I can't remember which exact phrase he used, but Islamic terrorism.
Yeah, I think that's a clear reflection in the direction that he's talking to Republicans. Most Republicans, as you well know, I'm sure, do not like the idea of climate change. And if you're picking out one category of people who simply reject the idea, that's that. So saying that is certainly, throwing red meat to the crowd. I do think that the average public, Islamic terrorism may not be at the top of their concern list, but amongst Republicans it is. So I think, it's a reflection of who he was talking to, primarily Republican independent voters, maybe Iowa to some degree, and certainly people who vote in the Republican primaries.
Now, one perceived weakness in the campaign of Governor Walker is that he's been a governor of Wisconsin. He hasn't been a player on the international stage. How do you think he needs to shore up foreign policy credentials and doubts that people may have.
I think that's a major weakness, frankly. I mean, governors all have that same weakness because they don't have the national stage in Washington. So he has been traveling. I think he was in Canada. I know he's been in Europe, was in England, Israel. So, I mean, he's trying to get around and at least burnish his credentials. The public generally does not vote to any great degree on foreign policy, so he doesn't have to do an enormous amount, in my opinion. You don't have to be an expert in foreign policy to run for the presidency. You have other people that can help you with it. So he spent a lot of time on foreign policy, I thought, almost kind of an indication saying he wants to really show you that he does handle that area pretty well. But it's a major weakness that he does have to deal with a little bit. It's to some degree, it's an education issue. You have to educate yourself on the nuances and the difficulties of foreign policy in various areas. And it's certainly an area that Hillary Clinton obviously has some advantage over him on.
We're talking right now with political scientist Joe Heim about Governor Scott Walker's run for president. And you can join us with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And there was an interesting take recently in the Washington Post. Political writer there wrote yesterday, and here's a quote, "It's clear that without the recall, there is no Scott Walker presidential announcement." This is an interesting sort of thought experiment here. Do you think that that is true? Did the recall essentially make Governor Walker the presidential front runner that he is?
No, I don't agree with that. I think that much of his national reputation actually flows more out of Act 10 and what he tried to accomplish and did accomplish his first year in office. The recall maybe in many respects tied him in more closely with people who were the bigger fundraisers in the Republican Party because they wanted to make sure that he got reelected. And as I think everybody knows, he's the first governor in United States history to avoid a recall. But by itself, I don't think that's necessarily the reason he's standing, on the stage and running for the presidency, though.
Now, immigration is a hot-button issue right now in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. There was not a mention yesterday in that announcement about immigration. This has been a subject that's been a little sticky for Governor Walker. What do you make about the absence of any...
Yeah, that was a little bit of a surprise. Maybe he doesn't want to draw attention to the fact that he changed his position on it. And he claims and says that he came through it honestly. He generally was in favor of immigration reform, of a pathway to citizenship, till he says he talked to governors from states that deal with immigration, Republican governors primarily, and he changed his mind on it. So I think as far as a flip-flop, you can get away with some of those, but it does draw attention to the flip-flop issue that he has had to deal with to some degree. And frankly, I'm not sure that he could have said something enough that would have Donald Trump, who is spending a lot of time on that these days. The unfortunate thing about his announcement is that he did it at a time when Donald Trump's basically sucking all the oxygen out of the political air. And so he did it on a Monday. I guess I should mention that. You know, Monday's a slow news day, and if you're going to pick a day to do that, that's the day to do it. But you don't really control the fact that Donald Trump's out there saying things about immigration and, frankly, dominating a lot of the national news on it.
Is all of that opinion out there by Donald Trump going to swing the issue in either direction or make things more difficult for the other Republican candidates?
Some of the Republican candidates are more moderate on that issue. So it really kind of, I think it's directed more at who you're really trying to talk to. If you're just focusing on a small number of electorate who are dealing with primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire, perhaps being on the anti side of the immigration reform issue will sell well. But as time goes on, you're going to be dealing with states more. And frankly, if you get into the general election, I think the public as a whole would favor immigration reform. At least that's what the national polls say. So I think it's a divisive issue within a Republican side and within the divisive side or the various portions of the Republican Party, there are people who favor it and oppose it. Obviously, by bringing it up, Donald Trump is focusing on those people that oppose it. But the governor, I think, maybe just decided to stay away from it because of the incendiary nature of it is right now. Congress could act on it also. I think people are acknowledging that's still a possibility in the next year.
We'll go to our callers now and take our first call here from Kenny in Rice Lake. Hi, Kenny.
Hi. I just had one comment. I don't know that Governor Walker's looking for a win in the election so much as he is looking for some national exposure. That was about the only comment that I had.
All right. Thanks for the thought, Kenny. There's some speculation there about that. Not that the governor doesn't want to win, but that he might have those Sarah Palin-style speaking engagements, other national opportunities down the road. But do you agree with that? He's not really in it to win it?
I don't agree with that. I think when you're in the top tier, and he is in the top tier in almost every poll, Larry Sabato does this analysis, and he's been in the top poll for months with three or four other people. I think he's certainly in it to win, and I don't think he's automatically thinking otherwise. However, that said, he would be a fine vice presidential candidate to match up with a lot of other people. So you could argue that he's, in fact, looking for national exposure, but if he runs reasonably well without attacking a lot of other Republicans, he would be a pretty good candidate for vice president.
Who do you see him matching up well with?
Marco Rubio would be good. I think he matches up with a lot of them, frankly, because they're not from the Midwest for the most part. Jeb Bush, I think he'd match up with fine. The national media tends to talk about our governor as being sort of a moderate Republican, but I think most people in Wisconsin would say that's not really correct. But if you're trying to balance your ticket, say with a more moderate-looking person versus more right-wing, shall we say, he would be a good candidate for that, or vice versa. But in general, I think he's got a lot of national publicity, and if he does well in the primaries, the national exposure won't hurt him at all. By the way, keep in mind that he's not exactly an old man. I think he's 47, if I remember correctly. That would give him a few more shots at the presidency down the road. So it's not automatic that this is his only time to be in that limelight.
And by the way, as long as we're speculating about VP choices, what if Walker is the nominee? Who do you see him picking? Anybody from that same pack?
Boy, that's a good question. I haven't thought that far on this one. That's a good question. I don't know if a Marco Rubio would take the vice presidency, and certainly Jeb Bush would not. So I think you'd have to start looking at other people. Rand Paul, for example, might be a good choice. For a variety of reasons, I don't think that Ted Cruz would be a logical person, or Donald Trump. So, but you're talking about what are we at? 15 right now?
15 is.
Yeah, it's you could go through that list and pick out at least a few of them that would be pretty decent, vice presidential candidates.
Well, luckily we've got a lot of time to speculate about that as we talk right now with political scientist Joe Heim talking about Governor Scott Walker's run for president. And you can join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234.
How do you feel about Governor Walker, our Wisconsin governor, running for president? Would you vote for him in a primary, in a general election? How do you think he'll be received going forward on the national stage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with political scientist Joe Heim about governor and now presidential candidate Scott Walker and his campaign.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Now that it's official, how do you feel about our governor running for president? If you're a supporter, what do you think he needs to do to stand out in a really crowded Republican field? If you're not a supporter, what are you worried about? What concerns do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. Marilyn joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I have some serious concerns about what Mr. Walker plans to do and offer as his view on education. There are those critics of his this is the second budget where there have been extensive cuts to K-12 education and now the extreme cuts to the UW budget. And from all appearances, it seems that the cutting of funding of public education along with the support for vouchers seems to be contradicting any thought that public education is a priority with Mr. Walker.
Marilyn, thanks a lot for your thoughts there. And Joe, what about that? Is the governor going to be in any kind of difficult position, or is his position on education a changes to the UW system tenure policy, the reduction in budget, holding flat on education for 2 years. Is that what people want to hear, the people who might vote for Scott Walker, or is this something that's going to be problematic?
In Wisconsin, I don't think those things have helped him at all. I think that's one of the reasons his popularity has dropped. The Marquette poll indicated that K-12 and UW system especially were not liked by the average public here by about 2-to-1 margin. But when you're talking to primary voters in the United States, Republican primary voters, education is just not high in their list. So I think he's playing to that crowd right now. Education, I hate to say it that way because I'm an educator, but I just don't think education is one of his high priorities. It's a long-term kind of a commitment to the future of the state and the nation, for that matter, and you have to have a kind of a really long-term horizon in order to really consider it a high need. So I just don't see that on his list. I do remember his first budget out of the 10 areas that were most cut. The three most serious cut areas were the K-12, the tech schools, and the university. Out of that bottom four, three of the four were education. That clearly tells me that education is not one of his priorities.
Well, what about the budget in general, the most recent budget here that we've had? It's been controversial. There's been some the UW system changes you mentioned. There's been DNR stuff, public school stuff. Do you see that budget coming under scrutiny and maybe causing trouble to Governor Walker, or is this more fodder for his policies and his reputation or his platform of being a fighter and a winner?
I don't know what was in his head when he was doing this, but a lot of people that read the budget said this is intended for national audience, not for Wisconsin. In other words, he can run on these things and basically say, I've tried to do this, I tried to do that, and it didn't always happen. Obviously, the Republicans in the legislature didn't go along right down the line with all he wanted. But you could argue that this was a budget, at least a proposal budget, was intended for a national audience. And he's going to come away with most of what he wanted anyway, with modifications to some of the more significant things. So it's on balance, I guess I don't think it's particularly helpful, maybe except, as I said before, with primary voters in certain states. But for the most part, I think there's good and bad in it, like any budget, Veronica. You know, you could pick out things, and he is going to pick out those things that the audience wants to hear, and he won't use the kind of things that maybe are more moderate or might be considered more acceptable in a general election. Maybe he'll use those later if he can.
Well, here at home in Wisconsin, Walker has taken a bit of a hit in the polls recently. His approval rating dropped to 41% in the latest Marquette University poll, that one released in April, and that one's down from 49%. That came out before the November 2014 midterm election. So how do you think his standing here in Wisconsin is going to affect his chances on the national stage?
I think that's going to hurt him. You want to go to the national stage thinking that your state is solidly behind you and you have very, very wide support for your proposals. Otherwise, there's a perception that you're just playing to one side. So I don't think that's going to help him, frankly. It isn't just the approval ratings, but some of the other things that the poll shows, the direction of the state. You know, roughly 6 months ago, the majority of people thought the state was heading in the right direction, and now it's the reverse of that. I think if I remember right, it's 53% now say we're heading in the wrong direction. So if people look at those polls, and I guess I'm talking about his opponents in the Republican primaries, if they look at those polls, they're going to be able to pick things out and say, well, he hasn't been that successful because the purple state Wisconsin isn't all that excited about it. He acknowledged that the reason why some of these things have dropped is because of his budget proposals. But he was taking a risk in knowing that. But whether that's really true, you know, it's hard to say whether that's actually the primary reason why his popularity has dropped.
Is that typical of sitting governors who run for president, though, that the people back home feel neglected? Popularity dips a little, and it's something that is typical and can be overcome?
I'd have to look at polls in other states, but generally my feeling is that most other states are pretty happy about having a governor run. It's a positive mark for the state, and I'll say that about Wisconsin too. It's a positive thing when a governor of a state runs and gets national exposure for that state. The fact that he's not as popular here is kind of the problematic area. But most governors that have run, I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, generally were pretty well thought of before they got into the presidential race, and I don't think for most of them the presidential race hurt them, frankly. But, you know, it's kind of remains to be seen as to how that's going to play.
We're talking to UW-La Crosse political scientist Joe Heim about Governor Walker's presidential run, and we go next to Steve in Stoughton. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I'm not a Walker supporter. I disapprove of pretty much everything he believes. But he was talking in his announcement speech a lot about, to me, firing up the political or the war machine. And I was wondering if Mr. Heim thinks that the American public is ready for more war.
And Steve, thank you for the call. Yeah, I believe the reference yesterday in the speech, you talked about increasing military spending. Again, what do you think about that and how the prospect of maybe future American entanglements abroad or maybe just strength here will affect people's views?
Well, you know, people's position on that kind of stuff changes when they walk into the White House. But that was one of those areas where very clearly I thought he was directing his statements at Republican voters in primaries. Those are the people that are primarily concerned and supportive of defense spending. I think the average public out there is much less excited about defense spending, and frankly, Congress doesn't seem to be all that supportive of it either. You know, even a Republican-dominated Congress seems to be willing to go along with some cuts. I think the public as a whole is, I'll say, a little bit war-weary after you've had two wars that have drained our coffers to, you know, at least $1 trillion each. I think the public as a whole just is not excited about that type of thing. But Governor Walker is going to have to walk a fine line on that one. I've listened to him talk about ISIS and you know, what he would do with the Islamic State, and to be honest, it doesn't sound all that different than what the president is doing. But obviously, he's criticizing the president for what he's doing because it's not working well. But it remains to be seen whether he would have to stick with that if he got to the point where he actually had to take action on it.
Well, after that speech last night, the governor is in Las Vegas today, a place with potential big donors, but also one that's in a state that will host one of the earliest caucuses. How important do you think is Nevada going to be for the governor's campaign?
You know, I would actually say the first couple are more important. Iowa especially, I think there's going to be a high expectation that he's going to do well. My understanding is he's been leading the polls there for several months. Not very highly. He doesn't have a runaway victory, but I think there's going to be an expectation because he's next door to Iowa that's the key for him. New Hampshire, probably because it's out east, and it's frankly not a typical state in the United States, if I could say it that way. Neither is Las Vegas. But I think he's going to hit the top four or five states and kind of see how things go. You know, he's been in South Carolina, you know, New Hampshire, I think he's been in Texas, but he's also raising money at the same time. So you have to think whether he's doing it to attract voters and or perhaps raise money. You know, one of his big tasks in this whole thing is to raise a lot of money.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Veronica.
That was Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's presidential run.